Alan Quinn Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2017. Lecture 17, delivered on April 3, 2017. The title of this lecture is Risk and Return.
Today, risk and return. I throw around the word risk in this class a lot. We are focused on risk. We are very interested. Everything that has to do with risk. When I taught economics for many years, it was one of the difficult things was that I knew that there was a piece in economics that I didn't teach that was critical to decision making. And traditionally, economics at the lowest level doesn't talk much at all about it. That's risk. In other words, decision making under uncertainty. Risk is just your uncertainty of an outcome. You could die today. I hope not. I want you to suffer through my final. But then you can die at will. Or you could die in 100 years. Probabilistically, it will be more toward the latter than the former. You, too, will outlive him on average, but I don't know. Considering that chicken nuggets lifestyle of yours, you could die from atherosclerosis tomorrow. You could die from a cut from that plastic, septicemia, you know, and all that. And so you could outlive him, but most likely you will die before they do. Trust me, it's worth it to die before your spouse. Now, we talk about risk in a generic sense. Most people have a sense that there is risk. Risk can actually take on different meanings. There is risk that is just you don't know all of the information that is relevant. That's a kind of risk that can be corrected. There is also a risk that is just inherent to a system. It would be beyond the ability of a person or even a computer to be able to figure out this kind of risk. There's a problem that comes up, it's discussed when I was a mathematician. If we knew everything about a person and a coin, all of the mechanics of that person's joints and muscles, the air pressure, the temperature, the humidity, and the weight of the coin and the distribution of the weight of the coin, if we flipped the coin with all of that knowledge, would we really have any uncertainty? Maybe not. So there are certain situations where there is risk, but the cost of overcoming the risk is worse than just taking the risk, bearing the risk. There's also risk that is just plain stupid. Have you ever heard of the Darwin Awards? Okay, the Darwin Awards are given out every year to people who've done humanity the greatest favor by taking their genes out of the gene pool because their genes were stupid genes. Now, the Darwin Award is given to people who do things like, for example, there was the year that these young men, risk factor one, who lived in West Virginia, risk factor two, went into an abandoned mine, risk factor three, and found some old blasting caps, risk factors 4 through 50. And then they bought beer. Risk factor. And they got drunk. And they put the blasting caps into a giant aquarium and they tried to explode them. And they wouldn't explode. Now, here's where it gets interesting. One of the young gentlemen, and I use that term loosely, pulled out a blasting cap and he did one of those amazing things that is predictive of a disaster. He said, "Watch this." And he put the blasting cap in his mouth and he clamped down on it. He bit down on a blasting cap. And that was when there was the potential for a Darwin Award winner. He actually lived through it, though, so he doesn't get a Darwin Award. He got an honorable mention that year. He lost all of his teeth, which actually in West Virginia qualified him as a breeding stock man for women in West Virginia. And his lips had to be reinforced because they were sort of flopping around like some Simpsons character. Anyway, there is stupid risk. Now, we appreciate that risk actually reduces over time. As people get older, they begin to know more. There is a knowledge factor that it begins to embed. Experience is one of those things that gets us past some risk. In the stock market, you are up against people who are of extreme experience, which means that pricing is based upon their understanding of risks, not the average, not the newbies. It's based upon the marginal player, the best player. Now, as far as risk goes, there is the lack of knowledge. Sometimes we have risk that is just risk that it's just there. We might be able to mitigate some of it, but not all of it. Now, as far as metrics of risk go, we have in markets several different ways to measure risk. There's a generic way that sort of forms of its own accord to assign risk. This is interest rates. Interest rates actually measure risk. A risky corporation will have to offer a higher coupon on a bond than a non-risky corporation. You getting a credit card, you will pay a higher interest rate on that credit card because of the risk premium in it than you would on a loan, a student loan, or on a home loan. Interest rates are a measure of risk, and they're actually, at the end of the day, the one that we use in practice the most. Another one that is used in a little more technical environment is standard deviation. Standard deviation measures the spread of possible outcomes, the spread of possible outcomes. So in other words, if we had two distributions, both of which were relatively normal, the spread of outcomes represents risk, how much likelihood there is of outcomes of different nature. And I'll get back to this one in a minute. This is more of a generic kind of laying it out for you. There's one, and I've asked this before, you've had your stats course, whether it was through econ or through the statistics math. There's one related to standard deviation, which is much more useful to us in business, honestly. It's called the coefficient of variation. And I ask students all the time, were you taught the coefficient of variation, the CV, how to do it? And there seemed to be a vague awareness, but it wasn't strongly emphasized. Just out of curiosity, do you remember the coefficient of variation from your stats course? If you didn't, don't worry about it. I mean, I'm going to show you how to do it. It's really simple. Basically, all it does is take the standard deviation and divide it by the mean so that different, and so that you can compare apples to apples. So a company that is very small would by its nature have a smaller a standard deviation than a company that is very large. However, the coefficient of variation, dividing both those standard deviations by the mean, makes it so the companies are perfectly comparable. You can look at their numbers and you don't have to worry about the scale of operations. This is how we do a lot of risk analysis in business, is by using CVs instead of your standard deviations. Okay. And now, the 800-pound gorilla is beta. Beta comes from standard deviation. It's in the formula for beta, and be very grateful you won't have to do many calculations of actual betas. You'll see that the standard deviation is all over the place in a beta, in calculated beta. And therefore, the beta carries the standard deviation, and when we calculate discount rates, interest rates, we use beta. We use a very simple formula called the cap M, and I'll show you that next class. But there it is, beta. So in other words, standard deviation helps us get beta. Beta buys us the interest rates. That's all there is to it. Now, I don't want to discount a couple of others. Others. Among the risk factors, of course, I had mentioned P/E ratio. P/E ratio is more of a rule of thumb. And I don't want to ever say don't use these rules of thumb like this. There's also fundamental analysis. And I don't want to emphasize this too much, but this goes back to experience. There's going to come a time in your life when you will no longer want to have people like you. You will no longer care what people think of you. Indeed, you will be an old bastard like I am. And in that time, you begin to get a cynicism, a watchful eye, when you see things in a way that others don't. Younger people, more optimistic people, people who have had brain injuries, you don't see the world their way. You see it in a darker way, so that the same information that everyone is saying is wonderful, in your mind, from your experience and from your cynicism, you say, no, that something is wrong here. I don't like this. There's something that smells bad about this. When I walk into a Walmart and I see empty shelves, when I walk into a company where I see fewer employees, when I go into a company and I see that there are a lot of people just standing around, when I see a company that offers too many sales, too many discounts, too much aggressiveness in trying to get people to buy from them, those are those fundamental things that you have to get out there and look at and ask yourself, why is this happening? Oh, it's great, they got salesmen who come right up to you and attack you. No, that is desperation, in my judgment. Or, oh, they're saving on costs by getting rid of some of these people that they have working here. No, they don't need to get rid of people like that. If they're doing that, then someone is telling them that the only way they can get their stock price up is to get rid of people. And if they're that hard up for a higher stock price, there's something wrong fundamentally with that company. That's that fundamental analysis, and it's part of risk assessment. Now, let me take you back here a step or two on the idea of risk. I'm not sure. I was going to show you something. Oh, this is what I wanted to show you. If I can get this to come up here a little bit. And this is, okay. This is a figure, I was going to pull one up, but this one actually is a decent representation. When we're talking about stocks, a company that is smaller is, by its nature, going to be a little bit more riskier than a company that is larger. That's just the nature of it. So in other words, when I am looking at stocks, definitionally, small stocks are going to have a higher risk than larger stocks. And here, risk is being measured by the standard deviation of returns. Not by the standard deviation of price, by the standard deviation of annualized returns. Okay, make sure you know that. I mean, at the end of the day, I really don't care what the price of a stock is. What I want to know is, did I make any money off it? Well, think about that logically. If you had a choice between knowing the price of a stock and knowing how much money you made off it, which are you going to want your investment advisor to tell you? How much money you made. So that's why we focus on returns and not price. And in this case, small stocks, I'd be talking about something like the NASDAQ, the National Association of Securities Dealers Automated Quotation. I would be talking about those, sometimes we call them the small cap. The small cap. You'll hear me use that term a lot. Now, taking it up to the Standard & Poor's 500, you're talking about the 500 largest corporations in the world, more or less. At least the largest publicly traded corporations in the world, I should say. Now, you in your lives will most likely work for one of these companies or a company that is wholly dependent upon one or more of these companies. These are monopolistic competitors. They tend not to die. If they do die, it's because of a merger or a takeover. So there's with small stocks, they can die in a heartbeat. There's always that risk, but there's also that risk means there's upside as well as downside potential that doesn't inherit to Standard & Poor's 500 companies. They tend to be somewhat safer on average, and you can see right here, their returns tend to be more tightly distributed on a normal. In other words, you're not going to see returns all over the place. You're going to see them tightly packed in a small area. In other words, there's not as much potential for upside opportunity, but there's also not as much potential for getting your ass kicked on the stock. And then, of course, corporate bonds, and I've gone through this before, and this is always a good question for an exam. Hint, hint. Is why do corporate bonds have lower standard deviation of returns than stocks? Well, it's obvious, and a lot of you have answered this one very well for me over the years. It's because corporate bonds get paid before stock. Bonds have the prior claim on the assets. Bonds get paid before stock gets paid. So the company has to make sure those bonds get their money. Which, of course, also on the other side means that you're not going to make a whole huge hell of a lot off most bonds. But they are very safe. And that's why they are good in a portfolio that's defensive, a portfolio for an older person or couple, a portfolio for a family that has a lot of money. I mentioned this once before, but it bears repeating. You folks live in a world that is actually, in some fundamental ways, different from the world that was here for the last, more than half a century. In this wealth manager from Country Financial spoke to my club students once about three or four years ago. She said, you know, a couple used to come in, and they were around 60 years old, and they could put $1 million into our wealth management fund, and we could see to it that they got $50,000, $70,000 a year. Safe. Not guaranteed, but very safe. And she said, now, to get that kind of safety, we're probably going to be able to get them no more than $15,000, $20,000 a year. The same $1 million is not going to get them a whole lot of money like it used to. So in other words, you see that standard deviation of returns, there's another part to it. Not only is the standard deviation of returns small, so there's less risk, there's also the average return has fallen over time. We'll never get back to those returns that we had for your great-grandparents, or even for your grandparents, mostly your great-grandparents. We're just never going to see that again. It ain't going to happen. Just ain't. And so there you are. Treasury bills, of course, are virtually riskless other than the bond. Oh, those are T-bills, so there's basically no risk. But actually, you see that standard deviation of returns. In other words, those things, just very likely that they're not going to move around a bit. Now, I'm going to bring up something here, is that if we consider a normal distribution, which doesn't hurt, but you've got to be careful. There's way too much assumption of that in our world these days. Without knowing the probability theory behind it, it's used too often. But here's the deal. The mean plus or minus one standard deviation designated by the Greek letter sigma, 67% probability that the actual returns will be there in that band from one standard deviation below the mean to one standard deviation above the mean. So in other words, if I were to tell you that the mean of the returns is 10% and the standard deviation is 3%, then I have a 67% chance that the mean, that the returns will be between 7% and 13%. 67% of the, I got to be careful how I say this, but think about it this way. About 67% of the time, your returns will be between 7 and 13%. This is just probability theory. This comes from probability theory. You probably saw it at some point in your stats. Now, the mean plus or minus two standard deviations, 95% of the time, I think it's 95% of the time, I think. So that would put us from 10 minus 6, 4%, and 16%, about in there. And the mean plus or minus three standard deviations, 99%. So in other words, 99% of the time, my average would be between 1% and 19%. As you can see, the wider the band, the greater the degree of certainty, which is kind of a trade-off. But I will tell you why this is important. I'll take a quick sidelight on this. Standard deviations and means are important in business planning. You see, because what I can do is I can look at a year, and these are approximately the actual numbers. The mean of my revenues I am projecting for this year in my own business, and this is just a real rough, it's not exactly this, but I'm just using this because it's easier to calculate, is about $20,000 in my own business as a professional landscape photographer, artist selling his artwork at shows and online in the United States and Europe. Okay, so now my standard deviation of returns, and this one's the one that's almost kind of creepy, is it's actually almost exactly $4,500. The standard deviation, that's over the past, over the past 4 years, the standard deviation has actually been very stable in my business, very stable. Before that, that recession was just killing me. We might have a recession coming. I've seen bad sales so far at the first two shows. But anyway, okay. So now what this does for me as a business person, though, knowing that over there, I can actually say, okay, it looks to me as if I have a 67% chance of having my revenues between $15,500 and $24,500. Now, why is this important? I need some new equipment, and I want to have a 95% chance. I've got to have at least $11,000 in order for me to justify buying new equipment. I have to buy the new equipment now, not later, now. So I'm going to ask myself, what's the 95% confidence band? I have a 95% chance of having my revenues between between $11,000 and $29,000. Just barely I can justify the equipment. Now, if my 95% confidence band was 10 grand, I'm not going to do it because I just don't have the, I just don't see it as justifiable. But because I'm 95% sure that I will be able to have 11 grand, that means that I can pay for the new equipment now and everything will be okay. Does that mean it's going to happen that way? No, but at least I know I have a good 95% chance that I'll come out okay. Even buying the equipment, I'll have 11 grand in the hopper for it. Okay, so that's why this is practical, useful. It's the kind of stuff that in business that we actually teach, that we use. And big companies use it just as much as small companies, although they break it down a lot more than what we do here. Truth be told, that's good enough for any kind of business I've ever been involved in. But anyway, okay, now. Yeah, there's that. So now, the next thing. Bear with me 1 minute. I wanted to... Now... I've done this one before, and I'm going to now formalize it. I'm going to formalize this. Whoa. Stay standing. I need you to do me a favor. Now, you have decided that you don't want to be skinny. No, stand up, please. You decided that you want to be muscular, indeed buff. Indeed, you want to develop a Swedish accent and call yourself Rolf, so that you can ripple your muscles and say, "My name is Rolf." Ripple, ripple. You may sit. You have decided that you want to be the Flash. You want to run at insanely high speeds. Okay? You have decided that you want to be one of those mentally, socially crippled, annoying nerds on the Big Bang. In real life, those are the most disgusting. We just beat them up. We give them swirlies, and they deserve it. You have decided, no, it's not going to work with you. You've decided, nope, not with you. What the hell? You decide you want to be a god, Thor, so good looking. Yeah, okay. I know, right? Okay, so you decide you need to start exercising. You're going to get yourself buff. Giant balloon muscles that stick out like this and all that. You start exercising. You ever see the movie Rocky? right? Yeah, you know, bah, 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 bah. And you start doing those exercises, and you put the raw eggs into the glass, and you drink them. I actually did that when I was young. I thought I'm going to be like that. You know what happens? Those get in your mouth, and then you, no, oop, they're gone, yep. And then you get a debris field about 5 seconds later. Rah! Okay, but it was bad. Back then, you didn't get salmonella, but you might as well have for what that was like. Okay, here's the deal. You exercise every day. You go to a butcher shop, you break in, and you beat up on a side of beef. You know, beep, 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 beep. You know, and the cow's, okay? You start running faster every day, faster and faster and faster. You actually stop looking at the internet for information and go to these weird old things called books and all that kind of stuff. And you start thinking more clearly and you're studying all these ancient texts and all this kind of stuff. And you start using emollients on your skin and you dye your hair blonde and you start growing it out. And you start learning how to swallow real hard and hold your chin up so that you have that chiseled jaw and all that kind of stuff. But you find out something. You get a little bulk in here, but it's not huge. No matter how hard you exercise, you can't get the bulk that you're thinking you can get. You think about using anabolic steroids, but then you remember what happened to Bruce Jenner. Too soon? You figure that you're getting faster and faster, and you are. So then you get on railroad tracks, you try to outrun a train. You go to your first nerd competition and you find out you ain't very smart. You're from Peoria with a mom from Decatur, okay? Yeah, you look better than you did, but still, on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, you're still down there in the low single digits. No, you are actually very handsome. God, you're muscular. Look at that red face. You understand what I'm saying here is that no matter how hard you try, there is a limit to how good the individual can get. No matter how hard you try to lower, to enhance anything, we know from physics, and it's a mathematics all its own. It's very cool because it's all through the universe, everywhere. Things that should not have anything to do with each other can possibly, the same principle applies. We call it the performance envelope. The performance envelope. It is a point beyond which you cannot reach. A performance envelope of a star. There is a certain heat that can be generated from its nuclear reactions. The same thing that applies to an animal. There's only so large an animal within a species can get. A person, there's only so fast that person can go. A car, no matter how much we tweak the engine, there's only so much power we can get out of an engine technology. These are all performance envelopes, and it happens in stocks, too. You see, if I were to plot risk on a vertical axis, and the number of stocks in a portfolio, on the horizontal axis. If you have one stock in a portfolio, you're going to get a ridiculously high amount of risk. Total risk. You put two stocks in the portfolio. An interesting thing, as long as they are not perfectly correlated, and that's an important thing, as long as they're not perfectly correlated, you actually have their combined risk is lower. Now, both of them could have the same individual risk, but when you put them together, this is sort of like a magic happens. We rely on this principle in insurance all the time. With three securities, they could all be the same high risk, but when you put them together, as long as they are not perfectly correlated risk, the risk of the portfolio goes down. And interestingly enough, as you put in more and more stocks into a portfolio, as long as they are not perfectly correlated, the portfolio's risk gets lower and lower. But what you notice is that it is actually approaching a baseline risk asymptotically. You remember that term from hyperbolas? You remember hyperbolas? We used to call them hyperbolas because our teacher was named Torcelli, and he didn't like us calling them parabolas, and he kick us out of the classroom. Anyway, okay. There's a performance envelope beyond which you cannot push a stock portfolio. For the same return, you can actually get lower and lower risk down to a certain base. But you can still keep your return, but you don't have as much risk. And that's why the stock markets are not going to reward you for just buying one stock and taking stupid risk, because you could actually lower the risk of the portfolio. Have you ever been on a high-speed interstate? Have you ever been in Germany?
No.
There's something called the Autobahn, otherwise known as light-speed travel. And I want you to imagine putting a little tiny car, like a little Miev, or a Mini Cooper, or something like that, on the Autobahn, where the average speed of cars is measured in warp. You have people with cars that they've modified engines from World War II airplanes, literally, driving along. And those cars essentially just get... The cars don't even hit them. It's just the force of the wind around the car picks them off the road. You see, that's the point, is that you don't survive in the market too long if you are going to be an amateur and keep taking risk that no one's going to give you a reward for, because you don't have to have that risk. You have that performance envelope right there that you can drive that risk down way, way down in a portfolio. This is the same principle behind insurance, auto insurance, life insurance, health insurance. The more people you put into the risk pool, the lower the total risk of the pool is, because they cancel out part of each other's risk. And then all that's left, if there is enough in the pool, is this underlying systematic risk. That right there is called the systematic risk. Think of it this way. That word systematic means in the system. It's embedded. You cannot get rid of that risk. It is just there. But all of that other risk is unsystematic risk. And you are going to get no reward for bearing that risk, because you can't get rid of it. You get no reward for a lot of the things you do in this life that you don't have to do. Okay, So in other words, all of this risk up in here, that probably, actually, almost, you could almost say it's infinite, is unsystematic risk. Now, I want to show you something here, and I'm going to have to reach here for just a second because I can never remember the name of the site. Okay. That's not it. Oh, it is. Yeah, it's called Portfolio Visualizer. Now, here's what I'm going to do. Before I talk about this, I want to go back and talk about the correlation, the importance of correlation. Now, the book brings this up briefly in this chapter and in the next chapter, so I'm going to get you very comfortable with the idea of the correlation. But to do that, I'm going to have to tell a couple of you about your lives, okay? I really don't want to do this, but I've got to find, okay. I need a woman. Well, no, not, yeah, at my age, no. Shut up, okay? You sure do the way you act, asshole. No, okay. We're going to tell about your life, okay? Now, this young woman was a very a healthy infant, came out very healthy, happy, and so her health care costs in her first few months of life were very low. She had a little colic, and then there was that demon possession when she was a toddler. And she had a few of the childhood illnesses, diaper rash, things got out of hand. She broke her arm a couple of times. And then she got to her rebellious years. She cut herself a few times. And then there was that acne. And then got in her 20s and 30s and fairly healthy. At 45, she had a cancer scare, and then she got diabetes, and she started exercising, yoga, found a young man to cohabit with, and then she had some kidney problems, and she got gray hair, but she lived into her 90s, and then she died. You're over there, really? Okay, now we got you. It was bad. You came out bitching like a storm, colic, diarrhea, blew your chow all the time, wouldn't eat right. But then you got a little bit better, and then things got out of hand, and then you broke a few bones. But you were a pretty good kid. I mean, but then you got into explosives, burned down the house and burned your leg. You got into your 30s, everything was okay, and then 40s, then you had a heart attack. Then your cholesterol started acting up. Then you bought a sports car and nearly killed yourself in it. And then you died at 70 from a stroke. But what you notice here is that they were not perfectly correlated. So if I were to put them together into a risk pool, sometimes when you were well, you were sick. Sometimes when you were well, you were sick. So there was like a smoothing out. Now, if I put thousands and thousands of people together And especially if I put people of different ages together, what will happen is over a large number of people, I will get a hum that is almost perfectly predictable how much we will spend in healthcare every year. And that's the basis of forming the premiums that you would pay. In other words, I don't care if you're going to get sick all the time or you're going to be healthy all the time. What I do care about is getting the two of you and all of these other people, the more people I have in the pool of different ages, different backgrounds, different ethnicities, different nationalities, different body types, the whole nine yards, they smooth each other out, and then I have a high degree of predictability of the pool itself. But it all depends upon you and all of you having not having perfect correlation. In other words, that whole idea, the kumbaya of diversity and all that, it's real in finance and insurance. We want diversity because that's low correlation. In other words, we want people who are very different from each other because that's how we get the entire pool to cancel out within itself all of the quirks of the individual types of people in it. That's how it works. And it's one of those wonderful things where we can actually say something that's fairly liberal in a conservative subject like this. But let me show you what that means in stocks. It means that when you choose stocks for a portfolio, if you're going to build your own portfolio, you want to find stocks that have similar betas to each other, but you want those stocks to have correlation coefficients that are fairly low. Now, if you don't remember from your stats course, correlation, the Pearson correlation coefficient goes between 0 and 1, well, negative 1, but 0 and 1 pretty much. Now, what we want to do is to look for securities that are not highly correlated with each other. Normally, we consider correlations below 0.3, correlation coefficients below 0.3, to be the kind that we would put those stocks into a portfolio because they more rapidly get rid of the unsystematic risk. See, if you get stocks that are like 0.7, 0.8, you have to put a lot of stocks in the portfolio for them to cancel out each other's peculiar noise. But with low correlation coefficients, now, in order to do this, let me work my way back. I'm going to just do January 1 on Sunday, first day, and the end date I'm not going to put in. And I'm going to want... Yeah, let's do daily returns on a rolling coefficient of 60 days. Now, let's put in some ticker symbols just to see how it works. We'll do Target, Walmart, Netflix. Anyone else? Call one. Say one. Coca-Cola, what's that one? What's the trading symbol on that? And what's Tesla? Tesla, hang on here. Okay. Seriously? Really? What is a trading symbol? Gee, that's a dumbass question. What the heck? Okay. Let me do Coca-Cola. Yeah, KO. And then Tesla. TSLA. So, TSLA and KO. And, let me try something in the defense industry. Nope. What would be another one in defense? Oh, let me do Boeing. BA. Okay, that'll be enough. Now, watch what we'll get. Okay, so what's Western Alliance Bancorp? Oh, at Walmart. I was putting Western. Well, that's good. That's a banking stock. Okay. Now, notice that Target actually is surprisingly low correlation against the others. And in fact, it's got a bizarrely negative correlation there. That's really weird. Okay, now, Netflix, against Target, it's got low. Against the bank, it's got a slightly higher. Tesla and Boeing. Now, interestingly enough, the ones that I chose, the only one that would be a problem for me, I don't know, kind of hard to call here, would be this pairing right here in the same portfolio. Boeing against the Western Alliance Bank is a high correlation. That one, you wouldn't want to put those two in the same portfolio if you didn't have to. Going for a few others here, let me take out that Walmart, WMT. I'm going to put in Walmart. WMT it was. MT. Okay, so now, Target against Walmart. They are very correlated. That's almost 50.50, which indicates that you would not want them. And you can you see the reason why they're so correlated? They're both companies. They serve different clienteles, but they're both in the same consumer products type of industry. Walmart, interestingly enough, against Netflix, they are actually negatively correlated, which actually kind of makes sense because one is a virtual company and one is a brick-and-mortar company. But interestingly enough, Walmart, it's actually not, as long as you leave Target out of a portfolio with Walmart, or leave Walmart out of a portfolio with Target, they are actually, you could form a portfolio from just these stocks fairly easily. So if you're going to build your own portfolio, one of the things that you would want to do is whenever you buy new stocks, just make sure that the correlation coefficient with those stocks against what's in your portfolio already has a little bit of, is a little bit on the low side. Now, one thing real quick here I want to do is Bank of America. Yeah, BAC. And I'm going to put BAC into the portfolio. BAC into the portfolio, and I'm going to take, interestingly enough, do you see Tesla? It actually would be good. It's a high-risk stock in a portfolio. Don't get me wrong about that. I mean, let me do real quick here. Yow. Oh, ow. Whoa. Hello. Okay. Is this a high-risk or a low-risk stock? You think? Yeah. Look at that, beta. Beta is above 1. P-E ratio is negative. It has no meaning. It's negative. No dividends. One-year target is a loss of 20%, a loss of about 17% on the stock. The volume is extraordinarily high on the stock. It had a strong upstroke day. That's interesting. Say that again. Look at that. That market cap is kind of interesting to me right there. It's losing money out the butt. But look at there again, that thing about it's losing money on paper. That's accounting. It's losing money. But notice how investors are still flocking toward the stock, which, I mean, the stock was up 7%, 7.25% today. $22 the stock was up. So there again is that thing that markets really don't care about whether the company is profitable or unprofitable. What are the future expected cash flows of the company? And the market seems to be, I'm not sure I would believe that one-year target estimate. Because right now, whoever's doing that is saying this stock is overvalued, which I mean, you've got to really show me that there's a lot of idiots out there trading in this stock to say that the stock is overvalued, and especially overvalued by that much. Nah. Anyway, okay, let me take out Tesla and put in BAC. Okay, I'm going to take out Tesla and put in BAC. Just to show you what happens when you put in different industry sectors. Okay. Notice that, wow. Is there anything that Bank of America and Boeing have in common? Why in the world would those stocks be so highly, highly correlated? But it can't just be because they are so freaking huge, and that's a technical term, freaking huge, because Walmart's in there. Why is Bank of America and Boeing so highly correlated? There's actually a reason for it, and I'm just curious to see if you would know it. Any guess? They're both companies that are extraordinarily dependent upon the government. Bank of America would have collapsed 10 years ago if the Federal Reserve had not been shoveling money in the back door and coddling that corporation and doing everything it can to keep that corporation from falling down. It's basically Bank of America is a sort of like a shadow part of the United States government now. Boeing is too. Boeing gets a lot of its money from contracts it has with our government, other governments. And it also gets a lot of its benefits from tax abatements, all those kinds of things, protection from bankruptcy by the United States government. Essentially, they're both subsidiaries, partly owned subsidiaries of the United States government in one way or another. Boeing provides military stuff. Bank of America is one of the asset managers of the United States Treasury. So those two companies are correlated for that reason. You would not want those in a portfolio together. You wouldn't think about this. You might think, well, they're so different industries, I'll just put them both in there because they couldn't be correlated. They are. That's why when you do this kind of thing with these correlations, you want to put these into your portfolio after you have looked at the correlation coefficients like this. Now, as I said, I will give you all the chance to do the quiz over again. I'll do a screen capture, and you'll have until, I'll get it up around 8 o'clock tonight, and then that's all I have for you today. I thank you.